500 years ago, he washed ashore the sole survivor of a shipwreck. And upon the skull of the man who killed his dad, he said, I'm mad, I must eradicate piracy, injustice and cruelty, and all my sons will follow me. So evildoers will believe that this man cannot die.
The Phantom!
The ghost who walked.
The Phantom!
Enemies beware, the Phantom's always there, but you won't find the Phantom. He finds you.
G'day everybody, and for those who have come in late, you're listening to Expand the Phantom Podcast. My name is Jermaine, and tonight I am joined by not just one, not just two, but three regulars. Dan and Stephen, how are you guys going?
Good, thanks mate.
Yep, I'm well.
That's good. And the third regular, I'll call him a regular because he's come on a few times now. John, how are you?
Good, thank you. I don't know about regular. I don't know if I've been promoted to that far.
Can we go with maybe we can go with regulars and infrequents.
Yeah.
Recurring guest.
Yeah. Recurring yes. guest. Yeah. So seeing you're a recurring guest, that means we're allowed to have Steve join us.
It's special guests only where Steve's out.
So this is episode 75, The Collection That Does Not Die. In this episode, we're going to be focused on the obsession that is our Phantom collections, why and how we collect, how we buy the items in our collection, how we store them, and what we plan on doing them long-term, including after we die. Yes, this is going to be a very practical podcast. I'm sure there'll be a bit of banter and a bit of fun and games as well, but this is going to be something that we have been talking about and discussing for a while, and I'm looking forward to this. This is something that we originally planned and talked about back in Supernova earlier on this year.
We've been kicking it around before that.
Yeah, so we have been. Don't
make it sound like we've been planning and getting organised, otherwise people are going to expect some sort of quality from this conversation.
Just because we've been thinking about it for the last year doesn't mean we've actually been planning.
So now the reason we've got John in is not just because he's the closest to the end, but because in all seriousness, we've got John because one, he's got probably one of the best collections in Australia, if not the world, but also because he has looked at a lot of different ways of, what would you call it, storing and restoring and keeping the collection in pristine condition. So that's one of the reasons, probably the main reason why we've got John on board. And he was very, very interested in the conversation we were having during the Supernova weekend as well. So one of the things I would love to see is a multi-generational collection, which I don't think we see too many of. But also, I hate hit. Well, if I had a dollar for every time I heard someone say, oh, I used to collect that, but, you know, I left them in the back shed, or my grandmother or my mum threw them out, or, you know, these type of things. We've all heard those type of stories before. So, yeah, it's... And what we collect, and it is worth money. It might not be worth as much as we think it is.
But, tell our wives.
Yes. So first of all, we're going to talk about why we collect. So, John, do you want to kick us off as the reoccurring guest? Why do you collect? And then we can go from there.
Well, I don't really know if I should sort of go into it too much, but with the therapist and stuff like that, but no, just joking. But well, look, initially, you know, it was just love of the character that got me started. Like, it's probably like everyone else, you know, I started just with back issues of Fru. Like, my first comic was I came in a bit late, actually. I did read them as a kid, but sort of went away from them and picked them up again around about 1070, The Dinosaur, something like that. But and then, you know, within 2 or 3 months, I was just hooked on it again and just, you know, spent every waking hour trying to find back issues, which was pretty hard back then because I'm sort of in regional Queensland, and this is 1994. So, I mean, there was no internet. And for up here, like your main place to get back issues was secondhand book exchanges. Then, of course, like the quality of the comic, you know, it had been read 3 or 4, 5, 20 times. So, it started with the comics, and then it just grew because the early to mid 90s in Australia, there was there's a large range of memorabilia starting to hit the shelves from Scanson and those sorts of places, like all the novelty shops started producing cups and mugs and all sorts of things. And, of course, there was the trading cards as well, which came out around a similar time. So it was just, everywhere you looked back then in the mid-90s, there was fandom memorabilia available, and it just went out of control pretty quickly, to be honest. You know, you just wanted to get everything, so it was just love of the character initially that got me started, you know. And it's like anything that you enjoy, you know, you want to track stuff down and you want to, get as much of it as you can, I guess.
Mm. So it's an addiction that you haven't quite kicked yet?
I haven't kicked it, but it's definitely changed over the last, 20, 23, 24 years sort of thing. I guess that's probably, we can talk about that a bit more later on, but like from wanting everything initially, now it's more sort of specific for me now. Like I don't actually want everything, so I sort of I start to pick and choose a bit, I guess.
Fair enough. What about you,
Stephen? I know you haven't really just quite really reached that mark yet, Jermaine.
Hey, we've been in conversation today. I've passed a few things off just this week.
Yep. But, I mean, that's only because you didn't really want to, did you?
No, of course not. No.
You're showing discipline because of the holiday.
Yeah. Look, what about you, Stephen?
What's the question again, Joe?
Why do you collect? Why back then, and why? Then has it changed? Has it changed to now?
I got more money, but no, I got more bills. So, probably got the same amount of money to spend on stuff. So, but I like what John said, because you like the character and you like to own something of that character. Like, I've got a few things that I've picked up, not just Phantom stuff, but Muppet stuff and things like that. And my wife is not a collector at all. She can't stand it. But one day she got onto eBay and just had a look at it. This was before I got right back into the fandom again. She went and had a look at this Muppet stuff on eBay. All of a sudden, it was totally fine to have that and to have this thing. And I asked her how much it was, and she told me, I thought, well, I didn't pay that. So she doesn't mind it too much. When things go up in price like that. I like to collect it because, a bit nerdy. I think it's cool. I mean, yeah, I reckon that's good. I want to own it. But I'm patient too. If something's not the right price or something like that, I can walk away.
Yeah. I think you have to be patient, especially unless you've got lots of money, like you've got one of those jobs that, pay you lots of money and You don't have all of the, you know, the kids and the mortgages and stuff like that. To an extent, everyone's going to be different, but you have to be patient. And I think sometimes that's half of the excitement as well, wouldn't you think so?
Oh, absolutely.
What about you, Dan?
I'll tell you the story later.
Oh, no, tell us the story now.
Oh, no, I'll just... No, we'll go for later.
when have you ever had patience, Jermaine?
You are a guest, we'll just remember.
Yeah.
It's a very fair question, though.
Well, no. Like, to be fair, like, I've... All right, I'll go next. So to be fair, like, with, because I'll answer John's question is, you go through stages where, again, sometimes you have a little bit more money than others, whether it's around birthdays or you know, sometimes you get a good paying job for a little bit. Like, you know, there was a period of about two years where I had a really good paying job, so it meant I had more spending money, and so, you know, you tend to kind of just get stuff because you've got the money. But, you know, one of the things that I had to change was doing up a list of stuff that I wanted and then splitting that up into categories. So, like, your must-haves, then you have your stuff that, you know, if it's there and it's a good price, you grab it, and then it's the stuff that, you know, if you've got nothing else to buy, you grab. And that actually... That actually has helped a lot, because there's been a few things that I've liked, but it's not been as high on the pecking order. So, say, for instance, you know, just recently there was a couple of things that I wanted, but one of them was a monkey's plate. I don't have a monkey's plate yet. So instead of spending my money on something else that was on my list, but it wasn't as high, I went for the higher item that I felt like I needed to have in my collection. So I think sometimes that does help when you're on a budget, which tends to happen when you have kids.
That doesn't really answer the question of why you collect, though.
No, it doesn't, but it does answer the question that John asked me, which is, you know, basically, do I have any self-control?
So what? We'll go back to the key question, though. Why do you collect, Jermaine? What got you?
Well, again, it was because before it was the things that interest me. So originally it was getting throughs to all of the stories that have been published in English. So basically from 700 onwards. So that was probably my first ever goal, was so that way I can at least own and read a story that has been printed in English. And then I just started buying a bit of everything, and then I got kind of hooked on comics from around the world. I thought it was interesting. So then I've focused on that because that interests me. And there was also the thrill of the chase, because I quickly learnt that there was no one who had everything of, you know, every publication from around the world. So there was that thrill for me, because it was like, you know, I wanted to be the first or the first known. So there was that. And then, you know, that kind of died out because I basically almost reached it. And then it was, I had a phantom room, so I wanted the thrill of the chase to be able to fill up that room with cool stuff. So the thrill of the chase is probably the big one for me, is I probably get the biggest thrill from the hit of finding it. And then, you know, like, even if I can't buy it, but I know someone else wants it, if I, like, find it for them, I still kind of get a bit of a thrill out of that, if that kind of makes sense.
It does, and I've certainly benefited from that in the last 12 months at different times too, so I appreciate that.
So what about you, Dan? Why do you collect?
This is, of all the questions we've got lined up for tonight, this was probably the hardest one for me to answer, because I didn't really mean to become a collector. I never really intended to. Like John was saying, I really enjoyed the stories and the character. And I'm surprised to hear, John, that you came on as late as that, because I've actually started probably when Frew was in the late 800s, early 900s, was when I first started sort of buying them every fortnight as they came out. And I just...
So why is your collection not as big as John's?
I guess because I haven't had the focus up that that John's had since then. Like, I had a period of... well, as I say, I wasn't a collector. I was just a reader. And so I've turned... One day I turned around and realised just because I was buying the comics and then putting them in a box and not throwing them out, I turned around one day and had a collection. I had 600 or 700 comics. And it wasn't that I was deliberately trying to collect them, although I, you know, would make a point of getting every episode, every issue. It was more just I was just reading them. And that's over blowing. It was probably 400 comics when I sort of realised, oh, I've got a bit of a collection here. And
700 sounds better.
Yeah. And I was a sort of a younger teenager, like 94. You mentioned there, John. I was in high school then, and so I was at an age where actually the Defenders of the Earth Phantom toy, I got that as a Christmas present when I was 8 or 9. And the monkeys, like mugs, I got one of those as a graduation present when I finished year 12. And, you know, so people would just give me Phantom things because I read the comics, and I never really made a point of going out to collect them. I joined the Phantom Club, the Hendo's Phantom Club, and I bought a few things off that. All the more low-priced stuff because I was just young at the time. I really wish that I'd got some of the rings and that sort of thing, but I could never afford them. And again, you know, I played with that Phantom Defenders figure to death. Not to death, because I've still got him. He's the toy that cannot die. But he's, you know, he's well worn, and no one else would want him. But he's one of the pride of my collection, just because I've had him forever. So I guess it's more not throwing stuff out, and then you turn around one day and go, oh, I could probably display this, and now that I've got room as a grown man and my own house and all the rest of it, yeah, turns out I'm a collector. And when I realised that probably 6 years ago now, I suppose, since then I've probably had a bit more of a focus up of picking up a few things that I didn't have.
So it's interesting just talking to the four of us that none of us collect for an investment. I'll probably ask you, John, because you've probably got the more impressive collection out of the four of us. When you buy things now, because you kind of did mention it, are you looking at it more from an investment point of view or still from like an enjoyment type of view?
No, I still buy for an enjoyment. However, I am... aware that it is considered, I guess, to be an investment, and yeah. I never really thought about it, to be honest, in that way, until I had to do a property settlement, and I was told, you know, well, you're going to have to value your Phantom collection, and I went, oh, you know, The figure that I came up with, it made me stop and think, because I went, oh, you know, what I'd been doing for the love of it and the enjoyment of it, all of a sudden, you know, someone had put a monetary value on it.
Yeah.
And I think now, it made me aware of that fact. And I know we've spoken about this before, Jermaine, and stuff like that. It's made me realise, you know, what a price guide is all about, I guess. That sort of angle. So I'm still 95% enjoyment, but I am, you know, that other 5%, I'm very cognizant of the fact that there is an investment value attached to it.
I've certainly said to my wife at times, especially if you pick up an absolute bargain somewhere, I managed to pick this up for $20 and I've seen it on eBay for $80 or $90. What a great investment this has been. And she always pulls me up short though by saying, so when are we ever going to sell that to recoup the money or make the money off that investment? Yeah. and she makes
it. Well, that'll be something we discuss later on.
I think that's an excuse we've all used one time or another.
And have you noticed it's always the same amount? It's always $20. Yeah. Everyone I talk to is always like, "What do you get that for?" Oh, it's about $20.
Yeah.
It's like $10 is too cheap, and then like $30 or $40 or $50 is like too expensive. So everyone just settles on that $20 figure.
Yeah.
So do any of you, is there the thrill of the chase that is important in why you collect for any of you guys?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's, especially if there's an item that you've had in your mind for a long time and you've just managed to pick up. And an example for me, I'll go back to that Phantom Club membership. One of the things I bought from Hendo was the Phantom Club cap. And again, as a teenager, I wasn't a collector. I enjoyed it. I wore it to school every day. Mum had to re-sew the brim for me after a year or so. School bully on the bus, you know, took great delight in taking it off my head and throwing it under the back wheels of the bus as it left school every day. So I really loved that cap, and I wore it to death, and it's gone now. I was very excited the other day, and I think it's the same place you got your monkey's plate from, Jermaine. They had the Phantom Club cap in the display box there, so I didn't hesitate. The price was probably more than I'd expected, but you don't see them come up very often, and I was just so excited to see that pop up. I couldn't get online quick enough to buy it, so I was certainly thrilled by that, and I can't wait for it to arrive.
Interesting. Love that. One of the other things that I like to collect is about stories. It's like hearing those stories from people. You know, sometimes it makes you grin with envy when they, you know, as some of our, as a certain someone says, he got the rub of the fairy or the prick of the phantom fairy. But yeah, it's I love hearing stories like that. There are people out there who collect a phantom who do it from an investment point of view. So there might have been, you know, they might have, you know, that I guess majority of them had that initial love for the character, but there has been collectors and there are collectors out there that do it from an investment point of view, and that is to make money from. Mm. So how do you guys view it? Like, do you think that's, I'm trying to think of a way of not, do you see that as more of a mercenary type of view, or do you just see it as where people collect things and that's just one way of collecting it?
It's just a way. Some people want to sell it off later and, you know, make a buck. Well, good on them, but, you know, you're not going to say that they're any less a collector because they do plan to sell it. It's just, you know, it's something that they like and they're into, and they know there's going to be a market for it. It's, but
I don't think it's any different from any other avenue of collecting. You know, whether it be coins or stamps or you know, motor vehicles even, or art and stuff like that. Like, you know, you're always going to have people there who are just, I guess, speculating with the market. And I think early Frews are a very good example of that. You know, there is definitely people just buying it for the value, you know, and hoping to make a profit on it after a period of time. I'm positive that there's those sort of people out there, and some of those people even may, you know, may not have a great interest in the character, but because of different things and different price guides and stuff like that, well, it's definitely made it another area where people can invest in.
And
I think there are a percentage of people out there who wouldn't obtain them from a bar of soap, but have 100 Frew issues under number 200 sort of thing, you know, stashed away somewhere as a part of their investment portfolio. Mm.
And look, I think all of us at different times would have come across, you know, something that's an absolute bargain that we may already have in our collection, but you've got to buy it anyway because you know it's going to be good trade value later or resale or whatever. you know, if I was to come across a box of Phantoms, you know, $400 or $500 for an absolute bargain, I would snap it up, fill whatever gaps I could, and then use the rest to flog off, I suppose. So, you know, if you can buy in bulk and save, and you can afford to do it at the time, and you want to keep two or three of those items for yourself, and then, you know, sell the rest off, then, yeah, whether it's mercenary or not, there's going to be different approaches, I guess, as John was saying.
Yep.
And,
awesome.
And you also mentioned trade as well there, Dan.
Yes.
And, like, yeah, if you can find something, you know, like that and buy it in bulk, yeah, that's an excellent, you know, trading currency, you know. You got all these comics and people want them, and well, they got that you could get, or you know, if people want them, then you can sell them, and then you can go get what you want. So yes. It helps feed the collection.
Yeah.
Mm.
No worries. Well, that's a great segue for our next question, which is how to collect. So say for instance, like there could be. So we're going to focus on how we collect. Whether you've got a focus. On what you collect, whether it's licensed or unlicensed stuff, rare stuff, local stuff, frus, comics, figurines, rings, for example, like Gary, who we've had on the podcast. You know, I had a fellow WA collector who I met up with a couple of weekends ago who's just focusing on figurines. So there's how to collect from a focused, whether you're from a completist point of view. So say for instance, if you have something, whether it's a fru or like say for instance UK comics, you have to have everything from the UK comics. Or
the trading cards is another good one that.
Trading cards or do you collect where you just grab what you can or anything like that? So there's different ways of how to collect. So, Stephen, do you want to go first, mate?
Right, yeah. Well, we'll start with comics because that's probably my main thing with the collection. Then, well, it's fairly easy. They come out every week or fortnight with there at the Fru. But then just keep your eyes out for I'm a little bit old school, or I just don't have the money sitting electronically to do a lot of online stuff. I do go to book exchanges and things like that. I've got a few, when I go to different places, you know, usually once a year, like around Victoria, and I know where the bookshops are that have got Phantom stuff, and so I'll pop in there. So that's with the comics, or if I get wind that something's become available, and well, then I'll try and make sure I've got the cash to transfer.
So your main focus is mainly your frus at the moment?
Yeah, my main focus is to get to have every fru from 1,000. That's just my focus at the moment. And I'm nearly there. There was a patch from when I finished high school through to uni, when I first moved down to Melbourne, which I haven't quite fixed up yet, but everything, like I've got stuff that from before I started collecting. So I started collecting around about the same number that was it 1070 or about 10 around about the Phantom Goes to War. Was when I started collecting.
I reckon 1063.
Somewhere around there. So I've got the 60 odd before that, and I've got, you know, a whole bunch more after it. But yeah, there's just that little hole. I haven't got my list right here in front of me, but I reckon it's around the 1200s, 300s, or 1300s rather. And I'm probably going to be wrong, and they'll check it and say, oh no, it's actually the 1400s. But you know, that's my hole to fix up there. But everything else, it's just if I come across it and I think it looks good, or and I like it, and I don't have it, well, that's how I collect it. So the other day was about 10 weeks ago now, seeing as it was the last school holidays. And this is where the being patient comes into it. I was in Mildura. I was in a secondhand shop. I just thought I'd pop in just to, you know, just on the off chance I had anything Phantom. And I saw the Billy Zane movie poster. And I thought, oh, that's all right. It wasn't in the best nick. And I asked the woman how much it was, and she gave me a price which I didn't like at all. I thought it was far too much. So I went and put it back and left. But I also knew that I was coming back in a fortnight or a month's time. And I'd just see if it was there and see how my luck went. And so I went back there a month or so later, and sure enough, it was there. And the bloke was there who ran the joint, and all of a sudden it was half the price I was quoted a month earlier, and so I picked it up. Hmm. So, yeah, it's just, you know, go into the second-hand shops, just on the off chance there's something, and hopefully you pick up a bargain is the way I do it.
1041 was the Phantom Ghost of War, so you were much closer than I was, Jim.
Yeah, I was just going to tell you that I was right and you were wrong, but you beat
neither
me short, mate.
Neither of us were right, you were just a lot closer.
I said 1040, that's
so you're wrong.
A lot closer. So, John, how do you collect? And has there been different stages of how you collect through your, 20-odd years of collecting?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Initially, like I said, it was just free comics. And then, like, with the internet and sort of finding different places online, and I guess probably the one that had the biggest influence on me was Chris Smith's Phantomania. It was just unbelievable. Like, finding him on the internet and then sort of getting some of the catalogues that he used to produce back in 1997, 1998, with all this sort of stuff from around the world that you'd never knew existed or never ever heard of sort of thing. It was just opened up a whole new world to me, particularly original comic book art. That was one of the key things, I think. It's the first page that I ever bought and saw, I just immediately fell in love with it. I'd never seen anything like it. That was the Luke McDonald page from the DC series. Was the first piece of art I ever bought. I came to a decision there and somewhere in the late 90s that rather than going down, to the early number frus, that I was going to concentrate more on artwork. I guess that's probably still the case now, but there have been certain periods, though, in the last few years where I thought, I want to fill a few more holes in my frus, but I think artwork still is probably the key thing that I collect now. That's changed a lot too. Like in the eBay at that stage in the late 90s was basically it was a US site, so you had to buy everything from the US, and it was you were getting hammered with shipping charges and stuff. And probably not as much as what it is now with that global priority program, but I mean, shipping was still, you probably, half the time, shipping was nearly as much as what you're actually buying something for.
Mm. It still is from the US, really.
Yeah. But I found, Chris Smith and also Friends of the Phantom, Ed Rhodes, they were producing their newsletter in the late 90s, and you just couldn't get enough of it. It was just unbelievable. Brian Shedden's website, those sorts of things. Like, there was a really big, Phantom following, I guess. But maybe to those people who read the comic, not to everyone, but certainly to me. And it's just. I think Chris Smith, he introduced me to stuff from Sweden, and the Scandinavian countries. Like, he just had stuff from all over the world. It was just incredible. And that was it. I took the hit back then, and I've never really sort of gone back from it, I suppose.
You actually saw, you actually went and visited his collection over in the States, didn't you?
Yeah, I did actually. That was on my honeymoon, so I managed to talk talk the wife into going there, spent an afternoon at his place, and just blew me away. It was just incredible, some of the stuff that he had there. All this very early, and like eBay had been operating for a few years in the US then, so you know, I think they had access to all this stuff on eBay that no one else, you know, ever knew existed, sort of thing. So I think, plus his networking, you know, through Scandinavia and stuff like that. Like, but you know, anything that you could ever think of now, like Chris Smith had it. It was just, incredible, absolutely definitely incredible. And I thought, I suppose, really. You know, walking out of his place there, I thought, you know, that's what I want. You know, so I can probably blame him for what's happened. But
so is that why he's disappeared off the face of the earth? All the wives, the Phantom Wives Club, have knocked him off or something like that. They've all blamed him for their husband's addictions.
Yeah. Yep. Probably. But I've never seen Pistol Pete Klaus's collection. I've seen photographs of Ed Rowe's collection, but I guess Chris Smith and Pete, from what I understand, were pretty close to each other, and it was just. And just to think that people had that amount of stuff, you know, it fills their house, and you think, you know, oh, this is unbelievable, you know, and just it really influenced me, I guess, to the point where I am today. I can blame them anyway.
So Dan, how do you collect?
I think that I've got a completist streak in me, because
I think everyone's got a bit of a completist streak.
Yeah, there's certainly a great deal of satisfaction to be had in having all of a thing, and so for like the Icon pop vinyls, for instance, I like that I've got all four of those. The file cards that Fru are putting out, I'm glad that I came on board from the start and I've got a complete set of those. The Phantom Art Show that's currently hooking around, I feel like I'd have as much available in terms of collectibles from them as anybody in terms of having the brochures from each of the venues and all that sort of thing. So once I start on a thing, I like to be able to see it through, but it is only usually if I am able to get on board early in the process. I tend not to, I guess, chase backwards too far, unless it's something that I'm really, really keen on. The Frues, for instance, that everyone sort of said that's where they started. With mine, I sort of had from about the late 800s, early 900s as a starting point. So I sort of set myself to go back to the 700 onwards, and then 600 onwards, and in the course of that, I've sort of got myself down to the, I think, 545 to present is my run. And I've only got two or three, or probably maybe 10 that I need to get back to 500 onwards. But I think, like most people, you start to find that below that they start to get expensive, and there are other things that you could sort of spend your money on and might look nicer on the shelf and that sort of thing. So, so a bit of completist. But other than that, it's got to be something that I really like the artwork on. If I like the scans and stuff has been mentioned, I like some of their stuff, but a lot of the Phantom artwork on the scans and stuff I also am not so fussed on, so I'm happy to leave that alone, sort of thing. So
how does that feed the completist side of you, having some of it and not having all of it?
Well, like I said, I didn't sort of come on board and get the first one. I do regret that I didn't. I'd love to have a complete set of Monkeys cups, you know, the ones with the triangle handle, because that's the one that I got as my graduation present. I've been able to pick up I think I'm up to four of those out of the nine that I'm aware of, or it might be 10. David Buds would know. And I'd love to be able to complete that set, for instance. But it's got to be something pretty special before I'll go back and chase to complete a set sort of thing.
Okay, cool. So, Dan, what about from a – do you mainly focus on local stuff or more
or
loud international as well?
No, I definitely focus on Australian stuff. I absolutely understand why you are trying to get a comic from every part of the world, and even as you were saying it before, one from every country, and being the first one to be able to do that, that's really, really cool. And everybody loves to have items or a complete set of something that no one else has or is a very rare thing to have, and I think we'd all like to think we've got, whether it's the original art that you've got hanging on the wall or whatever, that to have that and no one else can have it, that's pretty cool. But for me, if I can't read the story, then I don't really care.
Even if it's got a good cover, you said before you're interested in the art.
It's covers, like comics go in folders or boxes, and you don't really have them on display. I mean, I know you've got a magazine rack or something where you can display your comics, and Gary Horn, for instance, I know has got one of those spinning magazine racks or comic racks that you can display those. I don't have one of those, so maybe my opinion might change if I had a good way to display them. But it is also important to me to be able to have something. If you've got something, you need to be able to see it and look at it. So the comics, luckily enough, I've got a house where I've got a spare cupboard or wardrobe sort of thing, and all the comics are in folders in there. But I do actually much prefer to stand and look at my display shelf rather than open the doors of the cupboard and look at a bunch of folder spines sort of thing.
So, Stephen, do you have stuff displayed?
Yes, because I don't have anywhere else to put it, really. we got the front room, and that's kind of like my office-type thing, and so there's bookshelves, with novels, and it's got the CD rack and whatever. And, yeah, I've got a couple of things sitting on top of the CD rack and on top of the bookshelves, so... I got the four pop vinyls. They're sitting there, and the things from Ishkar, those book boxes. I got a big one and a small one sitting there. I've got the movie figure on the throne. He's sitting on a bookshelf, and leaning against those are the 2040 cards that I think I got off you, Jermaine, a year or so back. And I think I got a couple of rings sitting up there as well. So other things are. Yeah, in all sorts of different places, but those things are up and about. Ange hates it, but there's nowhere else to put it at the moment, so they're staying there.
No worries. So, John, what about you? Are you local or international first, like when you're collecting stuff?
I guess I don't really separate them anymore. It's just whatever. Yep.
And yeah, what about licensed or unlicensed stuff?
Licensed.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, so is there any unlicensed? So, all right, when you're looking at stuff and it's unlicensed, do you go on the quality of the unlicensed or do you just go nuts straight away?
I do have some unlicensed items, but put it this way, like, if you see some of the cheap things on eBay that you can see that someone's trying to flog off a copy or a badge or a magnet or something like that. Like, I've got no interest in any of that sort of stuff.
Redbubble stuff is a bit like that too.
Yeah, yep. From a collectability point of view, I mean, licensed is it. But in saying that, there are things, like the pin set from Brazil, which is... very collectible in my opinion, even though it's unlicensed. But generally, if it's unlicensed, I'm not really interested in it.
No worries.
What about you, Jermaine? Licensed or unlicensed, is that a factor for you?
It is. It's very similar as John. If I am to get an unlicensed, it needs to be on the collectability of it, but also like the rarity and what it looks like. Like, for instance, I've got probably 10 plus Indonesian comics and majority of those are unlicensed. I've got, you know, like there's those 2040 cards. They're also unlicensed from Indonesia. Got those that pin set from John, and that's one of my more favourite items. And then I've got some stuff that's been done from collectors, whether it's for dinners or little fan clubs and stuff like that. That, you know, is unlicensed, but it holds a special memory, or because there's a friendship attached to it and stuff like that. So while it's not collectible, it's desirable for me because of the story behind it. Or like a good example is, you know, my wife, and you know, she gave up trying to find Phantom stuff, so she got up a little bit of like a Monopoly money and changed it to Phantom money. So it was $100 I could spend on the Phantom. So, you know, I've kept that. I haven't thrown it away. It's not collectible at all. But
you've spent the $100 though, haven't you?
Oh, I'll probably spend $150.
But maybe she's trying to give you a hint.
Jermaine. Yeah. That's your cap.
So I think ideally the license is more collectible, but there are certain unlicensed items that are, and then there's also the story behind it that makes it special for you. Like another one is, for example, I've got a letter from Elf Granberg, you know, a personal letter to me. Yeah. You know, and I'm sure other people here have got letters from Jim Shepherd when they wrote to him and stuff like that. Now, you know, that's desirable and collectible. It's not licensed. It's just a letter. But, you know, the fact that it's written to you, it's a pride and joy in your collection. What about, like, because we've all said stuff about you get stuff to display. Like, I think, Dan, you said that you prefer to look at the stuff that you've got displayed than look at comics in your cupboard. I know, John, you're in the process of setting up your house to be taken over from by Purple. Is that a high thing for you as well? That does it display nicely and stuff like that?
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, I know you've seen photos, but like previously I had those floor-to-ceiling display cabinets where I had everything in those. And, like, it was just, you know, it was... There's no use buying something if you're going to stick it in a cupboard, you know? Yeah. Like, you've got to be able to see it. Unfortunately, I had to leave those cabinets behind. But it's only sort of now that I'm starting to get to a position where I can actually consider about how to display things again. Like, most of my collection's been packed away for the last 8 years, but definitely it's a high priority now. Like, I mean, I think most of us saw those photos the other day of from Lobo's collectibles, the way that they had that displayed in that cabinet. Like, that was just like, it just immediately took your attention to it. Like, it was definitely high on the priority to get my stuff back out and on display.
And I think
so. Does that mean you'll be quiet on buying stuff while you're trying to get that display, so there's a chance for everyone else?
Mate, I've been quiet on buying stuff for the last 8 years.
If that's quiet, I would hate to know what it's like when you are when you're busy.
It is certainly a factor, though. Like, I've got some artwork that I'd love to get framed and hang up on the wall, but to do that costs money that I could spend on buying more artwork. So you've actually got to make a sacrifice at some point and say, no, I'm gonna buy the get it framed, or I'm going to buy a display case and put some money into the collection that way.
A good tip if you've got like posters and stuff and you don't want to, or even art and you don't want to, you know, nothing beats a professional framed job. But if you're stingy or you want to frame it but you still want to spend money, a good tip is go to places like Kmart, Red Dot, the $2 shop and stuff like that. They tend to have frames from about the A3 or the A2 size down. You can usually get them for about $10-$20 each.
I'll do that with some things, but there's some pieces of art that deserve better than that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, but, you know, there is, it's just a good tip. If you're looking for display cabinets, wait for IKEA to have a sale on. They tend to have their little three-tier one on sale for about $100 once or twice a year. If you look for auction sites or that are local to you, there's always, especially in today's market, there's always shops, news agents, your little shops in like shopping malls and stuff like that that are closing down, and you can usually pick up display cabinets fairly cheap. Yeah, I picked up one for $20. There was a news agent they closed locally in Perth where they had those counter display cabinets, and they went for about $50 as well. So there's a couple of cheaper alternatives that might be useful for those, for some people. Mm. No worries. So we'll go on to the next way. So, and this, the next question, and that is ways to buy. So for instance, when you're buying things, do you buy art? Do you buy collectible and desirable items? Do you grab the bucket list, which for instance I talked about before, or even we also talked about before where you buy low and sell high, or buy low and trade high, or do you buy things for an investment point of view for a high return, or do you buy stuff that you just like the look of? So, Dan, we'll start with you, mate.
I think it's just I'm constantly trying not to spend money, and I've said that a few times. Like at Supernova, yeah, that's very true. At Supernova, my eyes started spinning, and I think I got pretty much one of everything that I could find, and that punched a big hole in my phantom money. But especially by the time flights and accommodation and all the rest of it, we've covered that a number of times. And since then, I've had a bit of a focus up of okay, don't spend every cent of your phantom money. You've got to save up again for next year. You've got to recoup this year and get yourself back in the. And every fortnight, you know, I get paid fortnightly, and every fortnight I seem to spend. You know, a good fortnight, I'm probably only spending 50% of what I am trying to save. Other fortnights, it's more 100%. And it's because something might come up that I've, you know, like the hat that I mentioned before, I couldn't pass it up. I couldn't say, no, I'll wait for that. I probably lack Stephen's patience in terms of going for that sort of stuff. Or there will just be a special event come up. And it's time to go again. So I guess the answer to the question in terms of how I buy, if I like it and I have the money at the time, I'm not as patient as Stephen, that's for sure.
No worries. So Stephen, anything you want to add to your patience?
No, it's pretty much if I like it and it's at the right price, I get it. And if it's not the right price, I will walk away.
Yeah. So what about you, John?
Look, I've probably had to pass on more stuff that I've wanted than I've actually bought over the last 20 years. Like, particularly eBay in the late 90s. You know, I was constantly getting outbid on stuff, you know, and that's. That's always the thing. I mean, there's always going to be someone there who's going to have more money than you and has the, you know, the ability to afford it. So I guess, like, I started wanting everything. I guess over that period of time, it's changed now somewhat where I only sort of try and go for things that I like. And, I mean... That's probably still 80% of the stuff, but I'm more focused these days on things that I probably like rather than because it's got the phantom on it. Definitely now. And for instance, like there's certain key things, such as like Mario Carrera artwork from Spada, from Italy and France. Like I just love those covers too, and I can't get enough of them. So, I mean, the comics, if I see them cheap any time, I pick them up.
So how many would you have, if we can ask you a rude question?
What, comics?
Of those, also those Sparta ones. Is that the original art or the comics?
No, the comics, yeah. Well, I think there's about 420 in the series that they republished in France. There's two series of Sparta in Italy. Look, I'm probably up to around about 400, 450, maybe 500. Just comics from, you know, Sparta comics, just because the covers are just brilliant.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, I mean, that's just – I get into those sorts of periods. Rucks. Where – Yeah, it is. But where you just focus on something, and then you know, just other things just sort of go by the wayside. Because I mean, another thing I've found is that, you know, it's always going to come up again. You know, it might be 5 or 10 years later down the track, but it'll always come up again sometime or other. So,
patience as well.
Yeah.
But maybe not as good as Stephen.
No. I don't know if it's patience. I guess it's just prioritising, I guess, is what it is now for me.
Prioritising, that's good.
It's just something that you like, or, you know, that you focus on sort of thing. Particularly if you can find something, if you've got a seller who's selling them reasonably cheap, you know, definitely jump on board and grab as many as you can.
Yeah. I think what you say about the prioritising is a great suggestion. I think you've said it, and I think someone else said it, where you can't have everything. I learned that very early on, that maybe I should have studied a little bit harder at school, and then I could have got a higher paying job, and then I probably could have afforded to have everything. Or if I married someone who had a lot more money than my wife. But seeing none of that happened, I had to prioritize. So for me, it was, you know, when I was prioritizing for comics from around the world, I had to overlook certain things that I kind of wish I didn't now. But the fact that is, you can't have everything. Sometimes you need to say, well, I'm not collecting this or this or this. I'm going to focus on this or this. I think prioritizing is a great.
I mean, you definitely at certain periods you get disappointed because you miss out on things. I mean, and that's probably one of the key things, that if you're seriously collecting, you know, disappointment is pretty much high on the agenda a lot of the time, because you know you miss out. Someone always bids over the top of you and stuff like that, you know, particularly eBay. Like eBay is just maybe not so much anymore, but earlier on, you know, like everyone was using sniping tools and stuff like that. And, you know, you'd be sitting there counting it down, and then with less than a second to go, someone would smash you, you know, and you'd lose it. So disappointment is a big part of the game, and something that you've got to, you've got to sort of learn to deal with and overcome.
Yeah, definitely. So for me, that's one thing that I've had to do is prioritising. I've got the bucket list at the moment. So John, art seems to be something that seems to be gaining momentum in the Phantom community. And I'm not sure whether it's because the people that are collecting art are a little bit more vocal than the way they used to be, or why.
Yep.
So
I think accessibility is the big thing now.
Yep.
I mean, particularly with the, you know, with different sort of social media platforms, you know, and, you know, groups on social media. Like, you never had that. Like, an original comic art has never really been a popular thing in Australia. Well, definitely not as much as what it's been in the US, you know. Like,
yeah.
And I guess from the early 70s in the US, it started sort of to emerge as a you know, in some cases, it's actually larger than collecting the comics, and particularly for investment value. Like, it's just unbelievable some of the prices that some of that stuff goes for. And I think in recent years, people are becoming aware of it more because of, like I said, you know, places like Facebook and those groups and those sorts of things. I think the Leaf Fork Club has done a lot to promote artwork. And it definitely it's becoming a lot more desirable to collectors now than what it used to be. Which is good and bad, because, I mean, Phantom art has always been affordable to the majority of people, whereas, you know, like, mainstream comic book art has not been affordable generally. And, I'm just hopefully, well, depending on which way you look at it, but, you know, I'd hate to see Phantom artwork get to the level of what some of the you know, the Marvel and DC stuff is you know, on the market for.
I don't think it will be, because you know, it
would have to be as popular as DC and Marvel.
Exactly, rightly or wrongly, Phantom is not as popular as Batman or Superman or Spider-Man. So, but original
but
art,
in saying,
art
in
can't
saying
be
that,
replaced. That is a one-off. Yeah. That's sort of what I was saying before about people wanting to have the only one of something, you know. If you've got like that that page from the DC comic that you were talking about before, John, no one else has got that. No one else can have that, because there's only one of them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was a big thing for me too. Like, you know, you look at early Frues, and even say the or even 200s, 300s. Like, you know, there's still. They're still readily available if you know where to look, sort of thing, you know, with dealers and stuff like that. And that was definitely one of the considerations for me too, that, you know, I'm the only person who can actually have this sort of thing. So, yeah, it made it more attractive to me to go that way, rather than a comic book that, you know, 20, 30, 40 other collectors have got in their collection. Sure. So
I was just going to say, what you were saying about the art, I don't think generally it will be as expensive as DC and Marvel, but there are some artists whose Phantom art still, probably not as much, but still reaches a higher market than other Phantom art. Like, and obviously there's the obvious ones like a Ray Moore, a Don Newton, and then probably also an Alex Ross as well would be another one that that if you're, and I think one of the reasons that is because a lot of people in art who collect comic art are not so much for the character, it's probably more for the actual artist, if that makes sense.
And some of those people will find value in the Phantom stuff because it is less popular than some of that artist's other work.
Like, for instance, if you look at like Don Newton, he's a fairly high collector. His stuff's got a fairly high collectability, and so there's a lot of people out there that have got Phantom artwork not because they're Phantom fans, but because they're Don Newton fans. Or a couple of months.
Yeah, and that's definitely the case in the US. I mean. U.S. collectors do go for artists rather than titles, you know, most of the time. Because their artists work on, you know, they might work on half a dozen different titles in their career, sort of thing. So, yeah.
Exactly. Another one was Alex Ross. Remember there was, what was it, about 6 months, 8 months ago maybe, John? There was those thumbnail sketches that went, you know, just literally thumbnail sketches of some potential Phantom covers that went, you know, went for a decent penny.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just straight after when the last Phantom was published, like his original covers, I think, were $6,000-$8,000 around that part.
Oh, wow.
On comic art fans. So, yeah. You know, and that's just because it's Alex Ross, you know, and it's not because the covers were overly great, I thought, anyway. But
And at the end of the day, the Phantom is still an iconic character. Whether you're a fan or not, there's a recognition that he was the first costumed comic strip hero and all of that sort of stuff. So there is that appeal still.
Yeah.
No worries. So we've also talked about buying stuff for a high return. So say, for instance, like, you know, you may have, you know, I know of people that may even be listening to this who, you know, who buy things for the purpose of that, you know, that they can pick it up cheap and then they know that they'll be able to swap it for something later on. There's, you know, like, especially if you buy in bulk and stuff like that as well. If you're lucky enough to find, you know, brand new stock or there's been people that will buy, like, talking about the art, that will buy a whole comic book and then sell off a couple of the pieces of the art to help, you know, fund something else and stuff like that as well. So these are all other ways to buy.
I think I can't do that personally because, you know, I'm talking about the budget.
You have to have money.
You've got to have a lot of money to be able to buy in bulk and go, right, well, I'm going to get 100 of this thing or an entire comic book of that thing or, you know, people who were able to snap up discontinued stock from a company that might go bust and this sort of stuff. If you're in the right place at the right time and have the right amount of money in your bank account, then good luck to you, I suppose.
Yeah. Another way of buying is there's always people out there that are looking to offload their collection for whatever reason in bulk or all as one. So, for instance, like, you will get more money if you sell stuff individually, but it will take time and you're likely to be stuck with stuff that, you know, people won't want to buy. And so I know of stories, and I've done it in a smaller scale where I have brought smaller collections and I say to them, look, I can give you this figure for everything and you've got money and you don't have to worry about selling it, or you can sell it off individually and then you can, you know, you might get more money, but it's going to take you probably 3-4 times as long. So there's another way of buying. And then even if you've got stuff that you've got, you could then use it to swap and stuff like that as well. Okay, so we'll go on to storage. Stephen, do you want to quickly head off how you store your comics?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'll do it, and then I've got to head off. Yeah, I'll go the comic bags, whatever size suits the comic, so Silver Age or Golden Age usually. And I put the backing boards in the middle of the comic, and I know some people don't like it because some of the ink can come off. But that's, for me, it's kind of negligible. Like, I won't go back and read a heck of a lot. Maybe I will, you know, in the future, but at the moment, that's a chance I'm willing to take. Mainly so I can see the front and back covers why I have that. They're in the long cardboard comic box, and I probably need another one of those at the moment.
No. So how do you find the comics in the comic box? Quickly before you go, Steve.
What do you mean? Oh, I've got a little...
So do you find it useful storing them in comic boxes, or would you prefer... Or is it just... That's the easiest way
to do it at the moment. Like, I've got a mate who's got drawers. He's got this display, and all of his are in drawers, and because he's got this whole room that he can do it in, which looks pretty cool. And yeah, if I had those, I probably would have done that, or maybe, you know, a couple out on display, you know, some with excellent covers. But yeah, I usually put them in there, and I've got, you know, I write on the box, you know, what the range is, and I put a little like a little file thing in there for every 100. So yeah, when I open up the box, there's the 1300s, there's the 1400s. It's fairly simple to get in there quickly rather than saying, oh, whereabouts is that comic? I know it's a 1400, and I've got to find it somewhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and the cardboard box, you know, you'll be able to write on it and you know, put a line through it and find it again, you know, if the range changes.
No worries. Well, thank you for your input tonight, Steve.
No worries. Enjoy the rest of your night. I'm sure you'll be here for another couple of hours.
No, you'll be able to listen to it all back when you edit it, mate.
So got one more assignment to go. Assignment from Masters.
No worries. So,
cheers, Steve. It's bad luck still having work, mate.
Yeah, you're on holidays now, mate.
I am indeed.
I feel like. Haven't said that I haven't been at work for 2 weeks. Well, apart from camp. What? Oh, that was more work than you'd ever believe.
No. Camp is double work.
Oh, triple.
So in other words, normal work.
Okay. Anytime you want to get a teaching degree and get in front of a classroom.
Well, yeah. Have a good one.
Night, Steve.
Yep, night, mate. See ya.
See ya, mate.
Now, John, I want to let you have the floor with this one. Now, a couple of months ago, you've been talking about it for a little while, but a couple of months ago, you showed us a few photos of what happens to the backing board being stored in a normal comic bag. Now, I must admit, I was a little bit surprised with some of the feedback and negative feedback you kind of received from posting it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I missed all that. You'll have to go from the start, please, John.
Okay. I guess I was just trying to highlight the fact that even using polypropylene comic bags and so-called acid-free backing boards, that if you leave your comic in them for an extended period of time, you will still get a acid stain, or the acid will still
leak or seep from
your comic book. And I sort of watch a lot of different comic collecting videos from the US, just to sort of get an idea on, you know, what's sort of currently in the market in terms of preserving or preservation and storage of comic books. And the majority of videos that I watched, people were saying that, you know, that you should change your bags and boards over every 7 to 8 years. And that sort of surprised me a little bit, because I mean, most people think that once you put it in a bag and a board, like it's protected for forever. I guess when I first started collecting in earnest back in the 90s, you know, and not being a comic book collector per se, like, or having access to like a local comic shop that stocked, you know, storage options. Like my first thing that I used to do was, you know, just the normal, what do you call them, the clear plastic bags that you put in lever arch folders. I was storing my comics in that initially, and I got to say that it only took me about 8 months to realise that there's a problem with that, in terms of acid, because you could see the acid coming out onto the bag. So I realised fairly early on that I needed to do something to preserve the comics. I mean, because I always sort of knew from early on that, you know, this was going to be a long-term thing for me. Like, it was a hobby, but it was something that I wanted, that I knew that I was going to, you know, probably do, you know, for the next 30, 40, 50 years sort of thing. Like, and I've always sort of had that idea that, you know, once I retire, you know, that I'll have the little sort of fandom collection set up in the room out the back sort of thing, and you know, maybe you know, sell and trade sort of thing a little bit more than what I'm doing now. But that's sort of getting off the point a bit. But the storage options were always an issue. So, I mean, I invested fairly early on in the late 90s in bags and boards. I mean, they're not a cheap sort of thing, particularly when, you know, you've got 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 comics that you've got to keep sort of bag and boarded. So I guess when I initially bought them, I thought that it was going to be, you know, I'm going to get 20 or 30 years out of this, or maybe even longer. But sort of after watching these shows on YouTube and stuff like that, and sort of realizing that, you know, there's only a 7-year lifespan with the poly bags. And the majority of US collectors, or the serious US comic collectors, were moving to Mylar bags, which the company basically gives a guarantee, you know, that it's going to outlive you. Like, it's like a 100-year guarantee. So, I made the decision to move to Mylar for all my early frus. Pretty much anything under 500, I was going to put it in Mylar. And when I started pulling them out of the box, you know, some of the, particularly in the 300s, you could see that there was a fairly significant acid stain in the bag and on the board.
Is Mylar expensive, John?
Yes, it is.
Okay. What sort of price are we talking per bag, for instance?
Look, there's not too many comic dealers in Australia who actually stock it. That's right. The big thing. I mean, you've got to get it from the US.
Okay.
You're looking anywhere up to, like, I've been buying them off eBay for about $25 for 50 bags.
And then shipping on top, or?
Yeah, and then a similar amount for the boards as well. So, I mean, so you're looking at about $50 for 50. So, yeah, a dollar a bag and a dollar a board sort of thing. And then you've got shipping, which, because of the weight, you know, yeah, it's look, you're looking at about $70 to get 50 bags and boards here.
And when you're talking big numbers of comics, like, I've got nearly 1,500, which I feel like is a big number, but you're talking 3,000, 4,000. That adds up very, very quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think particularly for the early frus is what was my key thing, because of the quality of the paper. It is poor to start with. I think probably the more recent frus, you might get a little bit longer in the poly bags than what the early ones will. But definitely, I mean, it's a big concern for me now, you know, like that I do spend that money to protect the comic. You know, it's like everything. Like, everything has got a certain age limit, I guess, before things start to break down and things start to yellow and stuff like that. And I think it's important that if you are going to seriously collect anything, I think there comes a time when you've got to put just as much emphasis on preservation than buying. I mean, that's difficult for a lot of people, because a lot of people are on a budget for start.
And that goes to what I was saying earlier about, you know, I was talking about framing up and whatever, but you've got to be able to spend the money not on buying a new thing, but on looking after the things you've already got.
Yeah,
So just a quick note, you can get Mylar stuff for art as well, I'm led to believe.
Yeah, I believe so, from specialty places. I don't think it's actually readily available, but not what I've seen anyway. But look, like something that's interesting, and I sort of, you know, 10 years ago I was made aware of it, that the majority of oven bags, you know, your cooking bags, is actually some type of Mylar. So even putting stuff in oven bags will probably give them a better protection than what the poly bag will.
So, John, what about...
Make sure you get it before the wife actually cooks that chip roast, of course.
Yeah.
John, what about slabbing comics, like getting them professionally graded and then and put in those hard plastic containers that you know we've seen from time to time?
Like you'll find the majority of those ones that are slabbed are actually placed in Mylar and then placed in the slab sort of thing.
Okay.
Slabbing is a very, contentious issue, I think, for Phantom Comics. I've got a couple of different views on it. I am a believer that if you're trying to sell a comic to some person, or say a person who hasn't got a great amount of knowledge on comics and grading, and you're asking a significant price for it, look, I think it's fair that, you know, a book should be professionally graded. And I can understand the whole concept behind professionally grading stuff. I agree with it to a certain degree. But then on the other hand, you've got and this is very, very much so for Phantom collectors, is most of them don't care. You know, most of them don't care as long as they get that book in their collection, and you know, whether it be an early number and stuff like that.
In America, it's more of a thing.
Oh, definitely, because there's money tied up with it. You know, because it's an investment. Slab comics are more so there for an investment type thing. But look, in saying that, I've got a couple of slab books, and I mean for display purposes particularly, they're great, I reckon. And yet, like I said, they're in Mylar, so you know, most of them should outlive you, sort of thing, or outlast you. There's always been a very people. Basically, don't want to do it for whatever reason.
And do you think that a lot of that's because of the price? Like it costs like 50, 60 bucks to slab a comic?
Definitely. But I guess really there's only a small percentage of frues, anything under 100, I suppose, which has got that value attached to it. You know, so you're never going to
go anything under probably 70 or 60 will probably be worth slabbing.
The thing that I personally have always had an issue with slabbing, I suppose, is that one of the reasons I collect comics is the ability to get it out of the bag or the plastic sleeve or whatever you keep it in and flick through it. And I know every time you do that, you're probably wiping dot points or whatever off the grading, but the ability to step back in time and actually flick through an old comic, the smell of an old comic, all that sort of stuff, that's one of the things that I really love about it, and the slabbing seems to just destroy that.
You haven't got that ability to do that at all, that's right. Like you say, I think there's probably 95% of Phantom collectors are the same, you know. They actually want to be able to look at it and smell it and those sorts of things. But I mean, the other argument is there. Like, if people expect big money for a comic book, then the buyer should be or should have the confidence that they're actually getting value for their money, one, and a correctly or accurately graded book.
And I think there's
a guarantee with it.
And especially those first, two or three Phantom comics, through 1, 2, and 3, when the reprint is difficult to tell, difficult to tell the original from the reprint, particularly number one, people are always, it's always a contentious issue. If you can guarantee somehow that's been professionally ascertained as being an original number one, then that's going to be a big deal.
So there's definitely arguments for and against. And I get in trouble for it because I say it occasionally, but, I do support professional grading if you're going to intend selling it, I think it's just for an investment purposes anyway. I think it's very sort of important, it's buyer beware, and we've all seen, even Johnson's Guide grades totally differently to Overstreet, which is like the acceptable standard of comic grading for every other comic book in the world. But the old Australian Phantom comic, no, we've got our own, and particularly too, you see some of the people who are trying to sell them on eBay, and the best line is, great condition for its age,
Yes.
And it turns up and it's, got rust stains and tears and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
No worries. So, John, how do you store your comics? Do you store them in the boxes?
Yeah. At the moment, I've actually got majority of my first collection are in shelves, standing upright in shelves.
Yep.
And all my spares are in boxes. But look, I really like seeing them displayed that way. Like there's a couple of collectors.
And Guy Besson does it.
He's... Yeah, Guy and Mick Strawn have got them in standing upright in shelving, and mate, it looks a million bucks. I reckon. I love the way it looks. And there's nothing worse than having 20 long boxes on your, in your spare room floor, just sitting there. We've got all this comics and particularly those ones with the nice covers. There's nothing better than having them out where you can sort of look at them and enjoy them sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah, totally agree. Dan?
Well, I feel a bit... of a goose at the moment now because John said before that he stored his comics in the plastic sheet protectors and put them in lever arches and said about 8 months in realised that was a bad idea. I'm 20 years in and that's what I'm doing. So
I did tell you that was a bad idea like about a year or so ago.
Yeah, I know. I know it's a bad
idea. I'm glad you're finally realising
that. I know it's a bad idea in a sense, but... It suits me, I suppose, and whether this is, I'm wiping value off my collection every 6 months as it sits there. I like to be able to open a folder and flick through it and see front and back. I like to be able to take a comic out. I like to be able to have a conversation with someone online and refer to an old story and then go back to it. Last podcast, I referred to going back and checking out the original stories versus the Scandinavian reprints of or redos, so and that's how I do that. I can easily go back and just pull them out. I don't have to worry about sticky tape and how the bag is folded and that sort of thing. It's interesting. Just as a point of trivia, that my first fru is I've got a single double digit fru and then I've got a couple sub in the 100s. But once you start getting a full folder of consecutive numbers, up to about 800 in the Fru series, you can fit 40 in a 40 issues in a ring binder or a lever arch folder. From about the time that Jim Shepherd took over, you can only fit about 30, and that's got a lot to do with the annual coming in. And then from the most recent folder that I filled is now very much in the new Fru Crew, and you can only fit about 20 comics in. So it's just interesting to see how the comic sizes have grown. I like what Stephen said about putting the backing board in the middle, and I realise that appreciate that there's problems with that, but being able to see both sides of the covers, especially some of the beautiful covers that are coming out at the moment, and one of the very few gripes that I have about the signature series that Fru are putting out is that you can't see the back cover in the signature series, and the most recent one that I've received is Jamie Johnson's cover for The Empty Throne. And the back cover's beautiful, but you can't see it in the signature series. So, long story short, that's how I do it, is the lever arch folders, and they're in the cupboard. But at least to me, they're easily accessible and easily readable and easily, you can find a story quickly, because on the binder of the folder, obviously, I write the issues that are inside it, and that's how I do it.
Yeah. I think that's probably the biggest concern, especially when you have so many comics. Like John said, he's got 3,000 or 4,000. I know of other collectors that have got that much as well. And having 3,000 or 4,000 in white comic boxes just doesn't work. You almost need a whole room just to be able to store those, because I'm sure we all, like you said, like to go back and read them or look at stuff. Another method, apart from the old shelf that John has been talking about, is, which I got from someone else on the Phantom Collector website, but I can't remember his name. I'm sure he'll know who he is a filing cabinet. Now, the advantage of having a filing cabinet, especially if you get wider ones, is that you can store two alongside of each other. Like a normal filing cabinet, you can open the drawer and you can kind of thumb through them and you can still read them and still see them. Obviously, they're not as displayed nicely as on a shelf, but it's another option. You can get like horizontal filing cabinets that are about a metre long, and they pull out and so you can actually fit a lot more there. You can buy them brand new for about $200, or if you look on Gumtree in your local area, you can get them a little bit cheaper as well. Now, as two guys who live in subtropical or tropical areas, how do you go with the humidity quickly?
There you go, John. I don't pay any attention to the humidity, so...
Look, where I'm currently living now, it's a huge issue for me. My house gets the afternoon sun, and it doesn't take long to heat up the house. So, I mean, I've always got air conditioning going in that room during the summer months, pretty much from 1 o'clock in the afternoon right through to sort of 7 or 8 o'clock at night. I've never used a humidifier. I know people who do, and I probably should look at doing that eventually. But I think I've just got to get my room set up right in terms of probably external blinds and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
That's my key thing first. Those sorts of things are definitely considerations to prolong your... To preservation of your collection,
yeah, for sure. Yeah, so if you're lucky enough and you've got a room, a couple of suggestions I would look at is shutter blinds. It's not just a marketing gimmick. You can feel the difference. Another one is because every room's got a window, having the window like south facing, or that part of the house under a big tree or heavy curtains or stuff like that, which does keep the sun out of it. Mine's at the front of the room, so it gets the early morning sun, and I got shutter blinds on the front of the house for security, but also to keep that section of the house cool. And I'm not joking, but in the summer I'll probably get a 2 to 3 degree difference because of the shutter blinds in my phantom room, which is quite a lot. Obviously, the Perf heat's a little bit different than you guys. But yeah, so there's a couple of ideas as well that I would suggest if you are serious to kind of look at. Another one, I know a phantom collector that's in a earthquake prone area. So, you know, that's something that you also probably need to look at if you've got stuff displayed in glass or if you've got things like a monkey's plate. And if you're in an earthquake prone area, a flooding prone area, like Queenslanders have had quite a bad luck of flooding lately. So, you know, these are other areas. Is your house built on in a swampy area? And if you get flooding, how's that going to affect it? So, you know, these are all other type of storage issues that probably need a little bit of thought.
Well, as much as anything, that probably takes us to the next topic, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, which is insurance. Now, Dan, do you have your collection insured?
As household contents, but that's it, not as a specific collection, no.
Okay, so yours is house and contents where do you have like a certain amount dedicated to it?
No, I don't think I do. It's something that I've been meaning to look at is to add the collection to the insurance. So
yeah. Only... what about you, John? Sorry, Dan, what are you going to say?
Oh, no, I was just going to say that in the last probably 3 or 4 months, I've made a point of cataloguing properly and trying to remember what I paid for things and now keeping that up to date to actually find out how much I would guesstimate my collection's worth. I haven't had the experience of John Ware. I've had to already go through and value the collection to know what it was worth. So prior to that, it wouldn't have even been worth telling the insurance company because they wouldn't, notice of that.
I think one of the things too that you'd need to do is I don't think insurers will actually just a lot of them won't just accept a figure that you think that it might be worth.
Yeah.
I think I've looked into it previously and like I can catalogue and then basically use Johnson's price guide. And really, that's the only benchmark that we've got to actually put a value on it. And you need to get like your local comic shop owner to sign off on it.
All right.
You know, to say that yeah. I mean, it goes to that level where they actually want it to be, it's an expert opinion basically.
Mm. So do you have your
collection insured?
No.
Okay.
Same sort of thing. I mean, I've got to, it's got to get to that point. It's got to get to that level, and I just haven't got the time to do it, to be honest. I mean, now's a good chance because I can pull everything out of boxes and, you know, whether or not you use a spreadsheet or whether or not you use a program like, there's a couple of good programs out there where you can, put photographs or everything in. It gets to that actual level where even you articulate grades. I mean, if you're going to put a value on a certain comic book that you might have, say number 50, for example, and you say it's worth $200, I understand that some insurers actually want it to be graded. Like, it's no different to having a diamond ring. You know, you could have a photograph of it. I mean, it's a horrendous thought.
Yes. That's the main key there that you just said. You have to have, if you're serious about getting your stuff insured, you have to have photographs of it.
Yeah. You've done that, haven't you, Jermaine? You've got photos of pretty much everything you've got.
I've got mine insured. I've got it grossly underinsured of what it is actually worth. That's because I've been too lazy to kind of
update it.
up it since 5 years ago when I got my house. So basically what happened is I built a house. When you buy a house, you, instead of just getting home and contents, you, or instead of contents, you got to get the home, you got to get the land and everything else insured as well. So I used it as a good opportunity. I just went into RAC, which is just a local car, but they also do home insurance and stuff like that. They asked me, seeing I've been a member for 10 years and stuff like that, they asked me, do you have photographs of everything and do you have a catalogue of everything? And as long as I had photographs of everything and a catalogue of everything, I was able to put a price on it as like a collection part of my home and content. So say for instance, if everything survives except my collection, or if everything gets destroyed but my collection stays, I have a payout of such and such, which includes your white goods, your couches, you know, your bed, you know, your DVDs, your TV and stuff like that. But then I have a collection insured for, let's say, 40 grand. So if it disappears in a house fire, I would then get paid out for my home and contents and then, say, 40 grand for my collection. So
and earthquakes and floods aside, it's that fire that's probably the most likely way to lose it, isn't it?
Especially in Australia. And you have to have photos and a catalogue. Some people use a ledger of some form. Personally, ledgers are great, but the problem with a ledger is where do you store it? You usually store it in the collection. and if you're in a fire, it's not going to go. What I would recommend is that we live in a digital age. If you can't, you know, if you can't famine the cloud, put your stuff in a USB drive and stick it in the freezer, because in a house fire, it will still stay alive in a freezer. So that's also a good opportunity if you've got family photos and stuff like that. Stick it in the USB and stick it in the freezer, as well as your passport and stuff like that. It's just some free tip.
There you go.
Regarding getting it professional grade, you can get valuers out there. So say, for instance, there's a lot of auctioneering companies that also double up as valuers. And so basically what will happen is they can come to your house and they can value your collection. A lot of the time they are mainly for house split ups and marriage split ups and stuff like that. But, you know, that is an option. For a day, you're looking at a couple of thousand, you know, you're probably looking at maybe $2,000 for a day. So it is pricey. For software, there's various ones for comic books, which is good, and where you can actually upload the image of your collection of that. Unfortunately, with the Phantom, there's not as many programs where you can kind of tick off, say, I've got this, and the condition is in such and such. So what I would recommend is taking a photo and uploading it to your Google Plus files, which used to be Pixar. You've got Flickr, which is like a Yahoo version of it and stuff like that. So, or you can even probably use an Instagram or something like that, where you can put it into folders and categorize it. And if you've got the photo, you can kind of use it like that. But yeah, if you have to use a ledger, I would recommend you using something like Google Docs, which is all digital. So, it's a lot more secure that way. I work for an auctioneering company. So unfortunately I hear a lot of this. You've got, like, for example, there's one guy, he had a tin toy collection, right? Now, this is impressive. So he's got the water-sealing cabinets of them. He's probably got maybe a couple hundred thousand different tin toys, all within their boxes and stuff like that. He died, and the poor widow is stuck with this collection that she doesn't want. So, yeah, it is a reality. So before we talk about that, I've got a hypothetical. John, if your house was on fire, what would be the one or the few things you would grab from your collection?
Most of my art is stored in folders in a big box. So if worst comes to worst, I could grab that box and probably save 85% of my art.
No worries. Dan?
Yeah, well, first, quick shout-out to my family. I hope they're all safe and have got out the front. Because they're old enough now that I'm going to leave them to it and I'm going to race downstairs to the Phantom Collection. And like John, it's the artwork. I'm lucky enough to have three Cyberry Sundays, and I would be grabbing those and hightailing it out.
No worries.
What about you?
To be honest, I have not thought about that. I would probably just run around like a mad headless chook, get suffocated by the smoke,
get my wife to
drag me out, and then I'll be saying, "Why did you drag me out? Why didn't you get this or this or this?" But no, in all seriousness, I have not thought about that question. When we discussed this and that was the hypothetical question, I thought, crikey. That's a good question.
So you don't have time to think about it. The house is on fire. You're in your Phantom room. You've got time to grab one thing in each hand. What do you get, and then hightail it?
I got absolutely no idea. Maybe my Sirocco, my Cuban sticker album, and then probably the same thing. I got a couple of folders of art because I guess they're some of the things that you probably can't replace. But, yeah, it's a hard question. Okay, so now we're going to do the somber part of it, which we
kind of... you suddenly has become real for you now that you've burned alive while you're looking at your Phantom collection.
Yes.
Just quickly, Jermaine, I think there's an interesting point there too out of all of that is at what point do you sit down and make a determination whether or not your collection is serious enough to go through all that to ensure it? Or, you know, is it just because, you know, are you happy enough just to have it because you like it, you know?
Yes.
Because you get enjoyment out of it and you don't, you know, if the worst was to ever come, you know, could you afford to lose it, I guess?
Yeah.
And I guess that's the same with any collection, you know, at some point you've actually got to sit down and think, well, you know, I'm at a point now where, you know, I've invested X amount of money into this and, you know, that's a huge loss if something was to happen.
Mm. Yes. Someone like you, John?
I think you'd
better go ring up an insurance agent tomorrow.
I mean, mate, there's other factors too that people have to consider, you know. It's not just as easy as doing that. I think people, you know, a lot of people may not be in the right financial position to consider doing something like that. I think it'd surprise them too. Like if you were to itemize your Phantom collection and put a dollar value on it, then take it to an insurance broker and say, you know, what sort of premium would I be paying for something like this? You might get a rude shock too, I think.
Yeah.
Yes. I think also, with what you said as well, I think you can't really put a price on it because for a lot of people, they have an emotional attachment to their collection. And I think this probably an over thing which we haven't really discussed is that a lot of things that people pay for their collection, they're never going to get that money back for. Some stuff they will. And I think that's something when you are looking at insurance or even when you're looking at selling, which we will touch upon soon, is that some things the value will go up, but some things... You know, like let's look at a good example. Frus from basically 1,000 onwards, you know, are not worth the money that we've all paid to buy them from a newsagent?
Well, not exactly. It depends on the grade, I think. I think if you've got a comic that you've read and it's got a newsagent sticker on it or something like that, I think you're right. I don't think you're going to get cover price back. But, I mean, if you've got a near-mint book that's never been read, I think you'll find you get your cover price back easily most of the time.
Yeah, well, okay, fair enough. And especially for charging, special ones.
Through a charging more than cover price for the ones that are still in their storeroom, aren't they? So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, Jermaine, and I think you're right to a certain degree, but I think grading plays an important part in that. I think, you know, the majority of people who just want to grab it to read it, you know, wouldn't be prepared to pay full price, you know, particularly if it's been read previously and, you know, news price sticker, those sorts of things, that those little things that detract from the grade. But I think if you've got... if you've grabbed a comic from the start, unread, put it in a bag and board, you know, I think particularly for some of the, you know, those people who are looking to collect it or want the best grade sort of thing, I think you'd, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're going to get your money back on it.
Mm. But, you are right as a general rule that the post 1000s.
And it's just a lot of them around.
It's supply and demand. There's a lot more of those around.
Yeah, and it's an example in the fact that with what we have all spent, like as a ballpark figure, Dan, what you've probably spent, what 50 to 50+ on your collection?
1,000? No.
Well, what's a ballpark figure you probably spent on your collection?
Well. My spreadsheet, which as I mentioned earlier, that's hasn't got any comics in it. I'll clarify that. This is only memorabilia, figurines, art, that sort of stuff. Everything except comics, basically. That's at around the $8,000 mark.
How long has that been for?
How long has it taken me to collect that?
Well, no. How long have you kept that ledger?
Oh, it's pretty well up to date in terms of everything that I've ever bought.
It's basically everything from the start of your collection onwards.
Yeah, without the comics, as I said, and as I've said, I've got from about 550 to present, and 1500 out of the 1800 frus in total.
No worries. And John, as a rough guess, and I know you know over 25 odd years of collecting, it's probably hard to. But where would you probably put your spending at?
Too much.
And yeah, not including the personal toll either.
Yeah. I don't know, to be honest with you, but it's a lot.
Yeah. And I ask that because, well, one, do you think do you think you would get your money back as an overall figure, on some stuff you're going to get a lot more money back than on other stuff, which we've already discussed. Yeah. But if you were to sell, do you think you would get anywhere between, say, what, an 80 to 120% return?
I think I probably would. It might take 6 months to offload it. But I think...
And that's for everyone to refinance their mortgage so they can buy it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think...
John, I feel like if you sold, you'd flood the market and prices would dive.
To be honest, there was a time there, Jermaine, and you know this, that a few years ago I started to think, well, you know, have I spent too much money on this, you know? Like, you get to a point where you think, oh, shit, you know? You start realising and you think, oh, maybe I, you know, it's time to stop. But, like, it's the enjoyment thing too. Like,
which we discussed at the start. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's not
an investment per se for me, but it is, because you're at that point now where, you know, it's worth more than, it's probably the most significant thing that you've got, you know. It's worth more than your car, you know. Well, it's not worth more than your house, but, I mean, you know, it's getting up there. Like, you don't realise until you actually sit down and think that, oh, geez, I've, you know, this is worth how much money that I've actually spent on it. That it is. It's a significant investment, you know, and none of us probably look at it that way at all. Most of us just look at it, you know, that's our hobby, that's our enjoyment, that's the thing that we love, you know, and that's why we do it. We don't do it to make money, but the underlying factor is there that it is worth money, and some of it's worth a significant amount of money. So, I mean, you just can't write that aspect of it off, you know.
Exactly. And to be honest, let's just do some quick figures. If you spend, say, over 30, 40 years, you spend 100 grand. And even if you only get 80 grand of that back, while you may look at it in the card hold hard of facts that you've lost 20 grand, the thing is you're still getting 80 grand back that wouldn't have in the first place.
You've got to look at that as it's cost you $20,000 to have 30 or 40 years of enjoyment collecting.
Yeah, exactly. So, you're right. So John,
that's right. I mean, that's less than $1,000 a year. You know, over 50 weeks. You know,
for the fun of it.
Basically, it comes down to nothing, doesn't it? When you look at it like that.
So John, Jermaine, before you move on, I think you need to go back and answer the same question you asked both of us. What have you spent on your collection over the journey? Do you think?
To be honest, I would not have a clue.
You got to stop asking us these questions that you don't know the answer to yourself.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
Well, no, because the reason I'm asking these questions is because I'm thinking about, oh, my gosh, what have I spent?
You do, mate. And it hit me. Like, all of a sudden, I realised that, holy crap, you know, it's significant. It is significant.
Yeah.
And when you look at other people's investments, like it ranks up there with, you know, other people's share portfolios.
Correct. Yeah.
For example, you know.
Yeah.
And you never really look at it like that, but the reality is that's exactly what it is.
Mm.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, for instance, like my wife is a bit of a budget maniac, so she's
she must cry herself to sleep most nights.
Yeah, she probably does, to be honest. She without me knowing, she basically kept track of everything that was spent out of everything, and she categorized it as, like, you know, like essentials or mortgage or phantom or, you know, entertainment and stuff
in
like
that order.
And she just in the space of a month, and I was thinking, I was looking at myself and going, oh, you know, I've been pretty good this month. I've not spent too much, you know. And she goes, did you know you spent $2,000 on Phantom this month, or, you know, or 6 months, or it was like a period of time, might have been 2 months
this week.
Or something like
that. I think a month is probably fair.
I'm thinking this week.
No, it's only been about $200 this week.
$20, I thought. you must have bought 10 things.
and you're right, it adds up very quickly. And I'm thinking, you know, I would have a good month or 2 months or something like that. And then she throws, oh, you know, you spent $2,000 on Phantom this week. And it's like, and then, you know, you do the maths. And then it's like, oh, yeah, crikey, you know, I have spent that much. So, I would probably say, I reckon I've probably spent easily $50,000. But, you know, and that's 20 years of collecting. So if you look at $50,000, you think that's a lot, but over 20 years, it's probably not that much.
And there would be people who would have put that much money through the pokies, or, you know, they're not going to see again, whereas at least you've actually got something to show for it, and as you said before, could sell for whether it's 80% of its value or you'd love you'd love to think 200% of its value or whatever.
Exactly. Everyone would like to think that it will reach 150 plus and stuff like that, but even if you get 80% of it, which, you know, is just the figure that we've just
plucked out of the air,
you know, plucked out, exactly, it is still a fairly decent return when you're talking about decades of collecting.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get on to the topic that basically I think is probably the scary part of it, and I think this is probably, without making people groan, probably something that we could probably spend the longest time on, but we'll try not to, and that is what to do with your collection. I'm just going to throw out a few possible ideas, and then we're going to talk about have we thought about it and what our plan is. So what do you do with your collection? Do you sell it before you die, i.e. you know you're going to die, you're likely to die in the next 4 or 5 years, and you're settling your accounts and you thought, well, let me settle all the stuff and then I could give the money or an inheritance to my children. Do you let your family sell? Or do you get one of your friends to sell for you, i.e., you know, you have someone that you can trust, that your wife knows you trust, and then they help you sell it? Do you sell it in one lot? Do you sell it over time? Do you pass it on to the next generation and have a multi-generational collection, which I'm sure we would all love to be able to do, but whether it's a reality or not? Or do you have it buried with you and be like the Egyptians, where you take your wealth onto the next life if you believe that? So, John, what's your plan? And I know this is something you've been thinking about, and I think you've actually changed your mind a few times.
Yeah, mate, if you knew you were dying, if you knew you had a couple of years, I would sell it.
Not all of us get to live to 80-odd, where we can go, okay, when I'm 75, I'm going to start selling. Yeah. You know, unfortunately.
I know normally people get so attached to collections that, you know, and you see it all the time, Jermaine, in the auction house. I mean, they can't part with it. I mean, they're so attached to it. Look, honestly, I wouldn't want to leave it for my kids to have that sort of, you know, they're going to have enough to deal with in dealing with the loss of, you know, their father sort of thing. Rather than worrying about having to offload a house full of fandom comics and memorabilia. I think it's very important that you make the effort. I mean, you're the one with all the knowledge. To know where to actually go to get, the sales sort of thing. I think it's important that you actually take the time to sell it, and because your kids would much prefer to have the inheritance in the form of money, but there's another word for it. Those sorts of things, rather than having the worry and the stress about trying to all float. They wouldn't know where to start, my kids. They would have no idea where to start.
And they would get fleeced, for want of a better word. They wouldn't get the value. Yeah.
No.
Yes. No. And there's been a good example where there's been someone who passed away way too soon, and the family was stuck with the collection and they didn't really know what to do. And we can tell you right now that they were about to get fleeced by an unscrupulous phantom collector until, you know, some people stepped in and kind of helped them. And that unfortunately happens. Mm. So, John, am I right in to say that your kids at this stage have absolutely no interest in the phantom?
Yep, 100% nil. And, I mean, they've been around it all their lives, you know. I mean... Yeah, to a significant amount of it sort of thing, and they got no interest in it whatsoever.
Yep. So you would go down there's a famous collector in South Australia who has been selling off his majority of his collection over the last, what, probably 2-3 years now.
How old is he?
So that will be your... he'll be in, what, probably his 80s? So what about you, Dan?
Well, the passing on to the next generation is probably still a dream for me. My boy, as everyone who listens to this regularly will know, is about 8. He's been on the podcast a number of times. He's come to the Phantom Art shows with me. He's met Paul Mason and loves Kid Phantom as a comic and that sort of thing. So I'm still at that stage where I'm hoping I can cultivate his interest in it. Even my girls, each of them have got a Phantom poster in their room, which they've asked for. So at the very least, I would like to think that they would like to nominate a piece, perhaps, to keep.
So in other words, if they want to stay in your will, they have to move it to their collection.
Well, I'm not going to go that far. The boy, I think, has got a chance of wanting to take the whole thing and become that multi-generational collector, which I think that's almost your perfect scenario. That is the collection that does not die and passes from father to son. And in the early one of our podcasts in the early 50s, I think 51 or 52, is the you'll know the name, Germ, the two American guys.
Yeah, I can't remember the dad's name, but the son's name is Greg Brandon.
Brandon, yeah, the Brandons. That story really inspired me, and I'd love to see that happen. But even if it didn't, I'd like to think that at this stage that they might each go, well, I'd love to have this one piece and have that as a memory of me sort of thing. I think what John said about if you've got time, if you know the end's coming, whether it's because you're old and there's a finite time for all of us and you know that that's coming up, or if you get a diagnosis or whatever. I have, in terms of, that, yeah, in which case I would like to sell it off gradually and know...
Maximise your return.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If it was sudden, if I'm in a car crash tomorrow and go... I've already told my wife, and when we were discussing this podcast, and I said, remember how I've told you? She said, no, I've got no idea what you're talking about. I have already given instructions, I guess, to my wife as to the best way that I would think to sell it. And I talked about my Leverage folders before. I think that if she was to put those on eBay one folder at a time rather than as a whole collection, or that's a way of going, well, here's a run of 30 comics that someone might like. I think that'd be a good way to sell it for her, the rest of it. Other than that, I think getting a friend to sell it, and whether that's some of the guys that I know from Brisbane, and if they're listening to this and they'll know who they are, or even yourself or Stephen, Germ, would be the sort of people that I'd encourage my wife to get in touch with and say, well, I'd love you to be able to sell the collection on my behalf or their behalf and try and maximise profits out of it or the inheritance side of things. And then, of course, you'd take a few things for yourself as part of the payment for that. Right. And I'd have no problem with that either. So,
yeah, I think that's probably the best way to do it. Like, and I've said that I've had the same conversation with my wife probably 5 years ago. I said, if something happens to me all of a sudden and you want to get rid of it, you need to contact this person, and this person.
Yep.
Find one of them. John is one of them. And I know John will probably do it for me, I hope. and you get them to basically help you because, let's put it this way. You die suddenly in a car accident. The last thing your wife wants to do is figure out how to maximise your Phantom collection return. They don't want to do it. They're reeling from the fact that their husband's died, the kids have probably got heaps of questions or, why and stuff like that. It's a horrible time. It's a horrible discussion, but it's a discussion that needs to happen, that you need to have a plan.
Yeah, absolutely. So it probably is worth... you know, maybe writing a note with a few names and phone numbers and contact details and whatever, and just popping in my case, on the display bookshelf there somewhere, so that it could be found by someone who's starting to look through it going, oh, what the hell do I do with this sort of thing? Because, yeah, as I say, you know, you said you have had the discussion 5 years ago. When I raised it with my wife this afternoon, she had no idea that we'd had the discussion. Partly because it's not a fun idea, and you're not, it's not something that you want to have, you know, forefront of mind. So,
no, well, you know, everyone does. You know, maybe you need to put a part in, as part of your will.
Yeah.
You know, we're all encouraged to have wills these days. You know, where the money goes to and what percentage and stuff like that. So maybe it's something that you need to put in your will, that, you know, what to do with your family collection. Yeah. We have, yeah.
I reckon that would be the best advice, is to put it in your will. In terms of selling the collection, please contact X, Y, or Z at these numbers, or this Facebook account, or whatever it is, however we maintain contact. For a start, that may be how they find out. So, for instance, if I went in a car crash tomorrow, I don't know it's going to make the news or anything like that. So,
oh no, I'll just like do something with the recording you've done where it says just give it orders from us.
You just cut that together. You'd have to learn how to edit first, Jermaine.
just something I just thought of, and perhaps it's interesting, but. Like you hear now, or you see in the US with comic book collections, that, you know, when they go to auction, like they associate them with the actual collector, you know, like it's the so-and-so or the Jermaine Parker collection, you know, and if you're known as that, to be, you know, a serious collector who's collected over 30, 40, 50 years, you know,
especially if there's hard to find items as well.
Yeah, right? I mean, do you think that actually keeping your collection together and putting it through an auction house and selling it, you know, advertising it, this is the Jermaine Parker collection, you know, that way of selling is actually going to perhaps get more interest.
Yes.
You know?
Well, we see it with the well, you know, like when the Fruit Guys started selling off their archive, and so it was sold as the Fruit Archive. We've also seen the Fork Estate stuff, which is another total whole discussion, which we won't get stuck into now. But, you know, we've seen two examples where Phantom collections have been sold as a title. And you're right, we do see it in America. So you, especially if there is iconic pieces, like, for instance...
So what's the word? Pedigree, isn't it? The Pedigree collection sort of thing. Yeah.
So, but it would have to be a big collection. Like, I probably don't think mine would be in that category, just being honest. But probably yours would, John, where especially because you've got a huge number of iconic pieces like the art. You know, there's a couple of other art collectors that we know of who have got high profile and large volumes of high profile collections that would probably be in that category as well.
Yeah. Well, pertinent part of the conversation, perhaps. What happened to the Ed Rhodes collection? Does anybody know? Like, he is an example of a high-profile collector who died suddenly in a traffic accident, knocked off a bike, sadly. Does anyone know what happened to his collection? And
no, I don't.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
And I haven't been game enough to ask people who would know.
Yeah, out of respect, I haven't either. But I mean,
but it's a good point.
Not trying to be disrespectful here, but you know, sometimes in those instances, the family finds it very difficult to actually make that decision, because that's the reminder of the person, you know, that's the reminder in you know, that's what's left to remind them that he's still basically there. So, I put it this way, I haven't seen it offered.
No, and it was only since you mentioned about the pedigree issue, John, because something coming from the Ed Rhodes collection, for instance, would have that extra credibility attached to it. Which definitely may make it more valuable.
Yeah.
So I think with the pedigree, it comes down to the person and the influence they've had in the Phantom community, i.e., like a like an Ed Rhodes. But then you've also got the actual what is entailed or what is contained, sorry, in the actual collection.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it goes back to stuff like grading and those sorts of things too. Like if you've got a very high graded, you know, collection, it's, you know, yeah. But yeah, definitely an interesting thing to. I mean, if you were going to sell it, or your family had to sell it after you, have it gone. I mean, that's definitely one way to which you might be able to, particularly if it's significant amounts.
Yeah. Like I said, we've got this elderly lady who's got this, and I'm talking about this collection will be worth a couple hundred thousand dollars. You know, we've got people from America and Japan and stuff interested in the collection.
The toy cars you're talking about?
Yeah, in the toy cars. But it is a huge, huge burden on her who has to pack it all up, who has to agree to sell it and stuff like that. And, you know, like literally this, you know, this job came to us like after we were having this discussion at Supernova this year about this is a podcast we're going to have to do. And, you know, in seeing this lady having to deal with it, it is something that you do not want to wish upon your family and your loved ones.
No, that's right. No. So, yeah, I think particularly, well, definitely for me, I mean, and there was a time in my life there was no way that, you know, any of this was ever going to be sold. Like it was going to, you know, I was taking it with me, you know, sort of thing. But the reality is, you know, and after having just gone through a similar sort of thing with my mum and dad, you know, it's difficult. It's really difficult, and it's just something that I wouldn't want to leave for my kids to have to deal with. I mean, they're going to have enough to deal with just with the grief process. So if you do have that opportunity to sell it before you go, I think that is the way to go.
Yeah. So, John, just on a lighter note, if you are looking to pass it on, you can adopt me if you want.
You're actually third on the list then, Jermaine.
Okay.
of adopted children.
But in all seriousness, if you are wanting to pass it on to one of your kids and, you know, and the other two don't want it, you can adopt me. I'll be more than happy.
Yeah.
Filing that under ideas to ignore later.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so is there anything else that we've discussed tonight? And it's been a very in-depth and a very somber conversation at times that you just want to quickly mention before we conclude. We've got a couple of questions before we end off as well.
Yeah. Look, I think really, I mean, I know we've been going for a couple of hours, but we've probably only scratched the surface, really. Honestly, and in terms of preservation, storage and all those sorts of things, I mean, those topics, if you really get into the nitty-gritty, I mean, you could probably talk for hours on them alone. You know, like the advantages of Mylar over poly bags, you know,
When you showed those pictures, it looked like you got a fag and you were smoking on that board.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like. It looked like a dirty old filter.
Yep. Yeah.
It was.
And I mean, that. Yeah. Yeah. It actually threw me to the extent that, you know, how much acid. Like, I couldn't really notice it on the book. But, yeah, like there's no acid marks on the book. So perhaps the boards did their job in that aspect, like of transferring the acid to the acid-free boards. But, I'm just hopefully Mylar. Like I've made the decision with Mylar. Hopefully that's going to, you know, I'm not going to have to worry about that changing bags and boards again. And look, something that we didn't really talk about was the cost. You know, even the cost of having to change your poly bags every 7 years and your boards is significant. And really, I think Mylar overall, Mylar overall in the long run. You know, if I say for the next 40 years, I shouldn't have to change it. You know, like the cost involved should actually be less than, you know, going through another four sets of bags and boards.
Yeah. And as Jermaine says, the price you've got to put on your own time in terms of doing that too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which you could be spending on eBay. So, Dan, has this discussion changed or made you rethink anything of your collection or how you store it or what to do?
It's reinforced for me that I'm doing the wrong thing in terms of the lever arch folders. Is it going to change my behaviour? Probably not, because of the cost involved and the advantages that I see, as I said before, and even the fact that I'm not counting my comic collection in terms of the cost that I've spent. I think that's the enjoyment factor. I'm not collecting this as an investment, no matter what I might tell my wife. And given how long this has been going, there's no way she's going to listen through to the end of this, so I can say that openly now. she never listens to a word of this, a minute of any podcast, so what am I kidding? For me, collecting is all about the enjoyment, and I think that's been reinforced when we talk about, well, over the journey, yes, it may cost you money, but that's money you're just spending on entertainment. I don't go to the movies very often. I don't spend a lot of money anywhere else, really, to be frank. And
well, that's it. You could be spending your money on the Phantom, or you could be spending your money on stuff, Loose Women, Fast Cars, Slow Dogs, and Slow Horses.
I didn't know about the Loose Women. I may have to reassess. No, so look, just enjoy it. Enjoy your collection and enjoy it for what it is. I'm pretty small bickies compared to some people. I'm big bickies compared to others. I know that, but I collect what I like and I enjoy coming down and having a quiet beer and just looking at the bookcase and going, well, no, there's a gap there. What could I put there? Or I haven't quite got that that thing completed, and maybe that's what I need to be chasing.
So what is that list? What is that want list? What is that number one on your list that you're chasing right now? And then while you're at it, is there anything that you've regretted that has gotten away as we wrap up?
Well, for me, the number one thing on my want list right now is probably, well, it would be original artwork from either McCoy or Ray Moore. And not just from a Phantom story, I would want to have a page with the Phantom actually in it. That would be the number one thing on my want list right now.
No worries. Anything that you regret that's gotten away?
No, not really. I think if it's gotten away, it's because the price was wrong at the time. And as I said, if I want it, I'll find a way to get it. If it gets away, it's, yeah, it wasn't the right time. It wasn't important enough to me. So there's probably not anything that's really gotten away from me that I regret. Look back and go, oh gee, I wish I'd upped my bid by $5 or $10 just to see if I could have pushed them a little bit further.
No worries, John.
Oh mate, I don't know, to be honest.
So what's the one thing that you're chasing right now, apart from more money?
Mate, probably the thing that I am most interested in at the moment is the Phantom bust from Fanfare.
Yep.
But I mean, original art's always on the you know, is always up there somewhere. You know, it's always high up on the agenda. Like Ray Moore, of course, but I'm not sure I'll ever be able to afford something like that. Wilson McCoy, yeah, you know, any newspaper strip art is just outstanding in my view. McCoy, Barry, even Olsen Williams is good quality art. And going, you know, you can pick it up now to the cheapest it's ever been. So, artwork's my thing, I guess. Stuff that's got away that I regret, it's hundreds of items over the last 20 years. Absolutely hundreds, you know. I used to just get smashed all the time on eBay and, you know, you'd be disappointed and down in the dumps for a day or two afterwards. But, you know, after about 10 years, you start feeling better. You learn not to.
I think you've got to be...
Does it take you 10 years to get over it?
Yeah.
I think you've got to be phlegmatic about that sort of stuff and go, well, here's the price that I'm prepared to pay. And if someone wants to pay a dollar more than that, well... You know, good luck to them, I suppose. So that's kind of where I've come to with that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and most of the time it's not, you know, it's not a dollar more. They've probably had a max bid that was probably, you know, $50 or $100 more than you. It's just that it was the max bid. So on my number one is still a South African comic.
Because that's the last one you need, isn't it? And then you've got
that's
one from
the last
everywhere.
One I need. Yes, that's the last one I need. There's only one comic that I actually know that I know that exists. So I might have to turn to A Life of Crime to get that one. Although Chris is pretty scary. For a small guy, he's still pretty fit. I reckon he might take me. So I'm not sure about that. And then one of the things that I've regretted and would have to be this 2040 animated Cell that I let get away. At the time, I didn't have the money. That's one that I kind of do regret. I know John remembers that one.
Vaguely.
Not as important as John.
It does look good on my wall, though.
Yes, I know it looks good on your wall. Alrighty-o, guys. Well, John, thank you for staying with us.
No, mate, thanks for having me back.
Dan, thank you again.
Yeah, and no
Steve,
worries, mate.
Thank you.
The podcast was called The Collection That Does Not Die, and it turned into The Podcast That Does Not End. So,
just weren't you blokes just looking at trying to cut them back a little bit?
Well, yeah, we were.
But well, then, we did do it with the last one, and we had people complaining that it was too short.
Yeah. And we, at least this one, fingers crossed at the time of speaking, but at least this one's been recorded, unlike episode 74. And that's a whole other story that we're going to go into on a different podcast. So, at least it's on tape.
All right, guys. Well, we appreciate you listening to us. I hope this has been of interest to you. It has been of interest to us as we've been discussing it, planning it, and talking shop. So as normal, you can find us on chroniclechamber.com. We have all the social media links, which you can find on our website. There's Facebook, there's Instagram, there's Twitter, you know, I think there's Google+. So, you know, whatever your poison is, we are on there and you can follow us. Don't forget there's Patreon. There's a very special Patreon extension that will be coming quickly. And then don't forget also you can subscribe us on iTunes or on your Android device so you will not miss an episode. And so it will pop up in your feed on your phone or on your computer and you'll be able to listen to us instead of listening to that terrible music they play on the radio or at work, which surely is a benefit. And then you can break out in song singing this beautiful song that you'll be listening to and everyone will look at you like some weirdo. So thank you again, guys, for joining us and for people who are listening to us. So from me, happy Phantoming, and from you guys,
happy Phantoming, everyone.
Happy phantoming. Oh, you blokes crack me up.
Five 500 years ago, he washed ashore the sole survivor of a shipwreck. And upon the skull of the man who killed his dad, he said, I'm mad, I must eradicate piracy, injustice and cruelty, and all my sons will follow me. So evildoers will believe that this man cannot die.
The Phantom!
The ghost who walked.
The Phantom!
Enemies beware, the Phantom's always there, but you won't find the Phantom. He finds you.